concept, but a brand new guest. And thank you to all of you who called in and sent emails talking about our guest, Dr. Loretta Bruning, who rejoins us today in the studio, along with myself and Kevin O'Donohue. Hello,
hey,
Kevin.
Ben. Hey, Ben.
Dr. Bruning, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us again today.
Thank you for having me.
And we spoke yesterday about your book, Habits of a Happy Brain. And it's a book about retraining your brain, which I think many of us are very interested in, because at our core, many of us are dissatisfied with the way our brain operates. So when someone comes along with a book that teaches us how to retrain that brain, well, you certainly have my attention, and I'm sure the attention of many others out there. And it's a big part of why we wanted to interview about this book and the concept. And yesterday, just to recap, we talked about basic brain chemicals like dopamine, endorphins, oxytocin, serotonin, cortisol, and how those chemicals interact with each other and how they're related to thousands of years of evolution and how we evolved to interact with our environment and with our peers. And as we like to do on this show, Dr. Bruning, and as you know, Kevin, we like to pay homage to the man who started it all, Armand DeMille. And for now, as a way to recap and get our daily dose of Armand in there, I want to share with you a short piece of Armand discussing oxytocin, one of the very concepts that we talked about yesterday. Take a listen.
Presence of oxytocin gives you a feeling of love, a feeling of caring. Oxytocin is a hormone and a neurotransmitter both. Once believed to confine its effect to inducing labor and milk ejection, oxytocin actually has far-reaching effects on both sexes. You could not fall in love without oxytocin. Now, this is a very interesting thing. The oxytocin feeling is a feeling of embracing, loving, caring. You could not fall in love without oxytocin. I thought about falling in love, and I was thinking about people who fall in love. Listen to this as an interesting hypothesis. No two people ever fall in love. That's my theory. One person falls in love. Sometimes it happens to two at once, but I think that's rare. I think it's one person going out there just ready for the moment, and the moment happens. The primary conscious behavior or thought process that increases oxytocin is caring. You care for another person, appreciation, generous touch, gratitude, emotional connections with others, these all raise oxytocin. In addition, the oxytocin appears to be behind many of the health benefits for meditation, massage, and acupuncture. So here's what happens. What are the health benefits that we're talking about? You are healthier in so many ways because once you have oxytocin, you calm down. A single rat injected with oxytocin has a calming effect on a cage full of anxious rats. Put one calm one in there, you know? That's why when you go to a meeting where there's somebody at the head who's leading a meditation, you know, and you go see the Dalai Lama or you go see somebody, it could be 2,000 people walk in, and here's this one saintly person up on the stage, and you all calm down. You feel the drop. Oxytocin increases sexual receptivity, and it also counteracts impotence. It's a kind of a funny thing. When you feel impotent, very often the oxytocin bonding helps you get past it. Oxytocin counteracts the effects of cortisol. Now, cortisol, we know, is the stress hormone, and you get stress hormone, you get all stressed out. And that's why a lot of guys, you know, they feel really stressed out and they go home and their kids are there. And they see their kids and they just love their kids. The kids kind of project, you kind of get this oxytocin working in you and you could relax into it. I don't mind when the kids want to play when they come home, they say. I could be stressed out, but the kids are fine. Instead, they come home and they're stressed out, and their wife says, let me tell you about the problems, that's more cortisol. That's more stress. Oxytocin. So now remember, we're talking about a hormone that we have, oxytocin. It has powerful effects on the body. It strongly affects your mind, your behavior. It's nature's antidepressant, and it's an anti-anxiety hormone.
That's Armand talking about the effects of oxytocin. He says a lot of nice things there. One is how attractive the person who has oxytocin is and the effect that person can have on a whole group of people. He talks about the rat, and one rat can calm a whole series of rats if he has a lot of oxytocin. The other is that it counteracts depression. And also that only one person of the two is falling in love.
Well, yeah, and that's a great point, Kevin. And there's another show that we didn't use, but one where Armand talked about how oxytocin can actually be very confusing to people. And the example he used was, if you make me feel oxytoasted, does that mean you love me? Does that mean I love you? And it's definitely a big question, especially, you know, we live in a time where sex is not as big a deal as it used to be, as far as, you know, sex between two consenting adults. There's far less stigma attached to it, and it happens a lot more often. And this is something that people have to deal with, is this feeling of oxytocin, or as Armand put it, you know, in a half-joking way, feeling oxytoasted.
It's almost like you want to be obligated to the person who's caring for you, who's shedding their oxytocin for you. But you're not really even sure, am I falling in love with their oxytocin or am I falling in love with them?
Right.
So
right.
You could feel toasted 6 months in and realize, wow.
Well, do I like this person because I really like them, or do I like them because they like me? That's another one. Yeah. A lot of people, they say, oh, well, I like the person because they like me.
And I can't tell you, when I was reading the book, I was thinking how this could be applied out in the dating world. Like, do you want to find somebody who has more of a chemical that you don't have, right? So if you're loaded up with serotonin, or if you're low on serotonin, do you want to find somebody who else is, you know, needing serotonin? Or do you want to find somebody who is exciting and has a lot of dopamine and is really anticipating the future? So it's just a question. It might be beyond the scope of today, but why don't you give a stab at it, Loretta?
Well, first I might mention that on my website I have a lot of slideshows, and one of them is called Why Love is a Neurochemical Roller Coaster.
That's what it is.
Yeah. So the ideal feeling we like to have is just this great floating, nurtured feeling all the time. And we don't have it because every one of these chemicals droops after it spurts. And then it's easy to blame your partner. You know, I felt so good about you last week, and now that spurt is over, and it must be your fault. So it's very helpful to know that these spurts come for specific reasons, and then they droop, and that's not necessarily. So the simplest example would be, if I could only get a date with that person, I'd be happy forever, because that's dopamine. But then once you get a date with that person, well, then it takes something more to turn on your dopamine.
Yeah.
So that's unfortunate. And it's the same for them. They may think, oh, if she would only look back at me, I'd be so happy. But then once you do look back at them, a few minutes later, their dopamine is gone, and then it takes something else. So a mature person can be aware that things are going to go up and down, so they could say, yeah, you have high serotonin, as you use the example, and I have low serotonin, so I can try to learn from you and to understand, but I can't put that burden on you that if I don't feel good all the time when I'm with you, then there must be something wrong with you or the relationship. So it's hard to draw that line.
Yeah. Is this part of the concept of grafting, or is this mirroring when you're doing that with somebody? Not putting the burden or responsibility on them, but actually feeding a little bit off them unconsciously.
Grafting and mirroring are examples of tools that I use in the book. So mirroring is, we have mirror neurons where when another person gets a reward or avoids pain, or experiences pain, we learn from it. It actually triggers the same pattern in our brain. And you say, oh, so that's how it's done. That's literally how animals learn survival skills before language existed. So if I, let's say I'm shy, and I see you go up to people and say, hi, my name's Kevin, how you doing? I'm like, oh, so it's that easy. You know, so that would be an example of mirroring. But then you used grafting. So the funny example of grafting would be, let's say I'm an older person, I go through a divorce, and then it's hard for me to get excited by anyone. And then you know what I'm going to say, I see that old flame on Facebook.
From high school.
Yes.
And that's the important part of it, isn't it?
Exactly, because that's when your neural pathways were built for reasons we can talk about. And so that person turns on, and I'm not saying you got to do that or that person is really a better person, but your happy chemicals flow effortlessly, and that's how we perceive is what's the right thing.
Right.
That is fascinating, and I think it's, I think it explains a lot. What I'm curious about, Dr. Bruning, is, you know, we get so kind of, for lack of a better term, stuck in our ways. And you hear the phrase, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, right? But at the same time, you've created a strategy and an outline for how we can break through and rewire what we've learned, rewire our brains. And that's, what to me, one of the most fascinating parts of your book. I'm wondering if you can walk us through, here in the studio and for our listeners at home and in the car, if you can walk us through what 45 days of rewiring a brain looks like.
Sure. So there's this currently trendy idea of we can learn at any time and our neurons are always reproducing. But it's much more complicated than that, because at the deeper level of your, effectively your operating system of your happy chemicals, that relies on neural pathways built in youth, because we are born stupid with no knowledge. And we got to wire ourselves up pretty fast, because in the state of nature, you know, if your parents got killed and you needed some survival skills or you'd die. So,
well, when you say we're born stupid, you mean we're not born with any skills or strategies to survive?
Yes. So yesterday we spoke of, we're born with billions of neurons, but almost no connections between them, unlike simpler animals that are born hardwired with the finished circuits. And that frees us to learn from individual experience rather than being born to always, you know, jump at a moving target, regardless of what the target is.
So it's good to be human, to have a human brain. You have your own free will. You can choose how you make your circuits and how you make your connections. Whereas these poor animals out in the wild, they've been passed down their brain from generations and generations and have the same neural pathways.
Well, I think that's a great point, Kevin, and that's something that does get touched on in the book. And again, the book we're talking about is called Habits of a Happy Brain: Retrain Your Brain to Boost Your Serotonin, Dopamine, Oxytocin, and Endorphin Levels. And we're here in the studio with the author of that book, Loretta Bruning. She's the founder of the Inner Mammal Institute, which you told us a little bit about yesterday. Very interesting stuff. And a professor at Cal State University, and as well as the author of several other books. You also have an interesting blog on psychologytoday.com that our listeners can check out. And all around, you know, the work that you do is fascinating to me, Dr. Bruning, because I've always felt a kinship and connection with animals, and especially monkeys. And a lot of your explanations, they use that animal instinct to explain much of our behaviors and impulses and instincts. And I think that that is a great teaching tool to better understand our brains.
Yeah. Kevin, you mentioned that we can choose our patterns, our circuits, but the complicated thing is that our brains are designed to build their foundational circuits before age 8 and during puberty. And so we don't really have really the wisdom to choose at that point. So the simplest example, and this has a monkey analogy, when you're born, you're hungry. Hunger is pain and cortisol from the brain's perspective, but your brain doesn't know how to get food. And in fact, it doesn't know what food is. In fact, it doesn't know what a mother is. So all it knows is whoa, now I feel better when the milk goes in. Mm. And so then it learns to connect the sound of your mother to the milk and the expectation of feeling safe and feeling better. And so when you hear a noise that your mother made, that builds a pathway that says, oh, now I'm going to feel good.
Well, we talked yesterday about endorphins and their relation to morphine, and how morphine is generally accepted to be a synthetic version of the naturally occurring endorphin chemical. I have read that baby, an infant that's breastfeeding, is actually reacting to the breast milk, synthesizing that breast milk into an opiate-like response, which kind of ties into what you're talking about the endorphins connected to that.
Hmm. I haven't heard that one, but endorphin is stimulated by pain, and that includes a little bit from laughing and also from crying. So I'm wondering if there's the crying, and also perhaps that, as I said, hunger is pain, and so perhaps there's some of that, but it has to be like a lot of hunger, like if the baby really didn't get fed.
All day.
And we all know how good crying feels.
Sure.
You know, you go years without it, and then all of a sudden you have it. Can you do this artificially? I mean, can you laugh, just ha-ha, wake up, laugh artificially and get a spike in your brain chemistry?
There's a school of thought that says yes, and I don't want to pour cold water on them, but my view is that it's the real physical convulsions that trigger it. So it has to be a real laugh to me, and so my personal choice is to make time for things that are funny to me. So rather than saying, okay, I have 2 minutes, ha ha ha, ha
right,
you know,
right.
is to say, I'm going to give myself 2 hours. I'm going to watch a movie. If I don't like it, I'm going to kill it and try another one.
Right.
To give myself permission to shop for things that give me pleasure, even though it's not fully predictable.
And I guess you can do the same thing with crying. You could find a sad movie, sad music. Give yourself some time to get this convulsion going.
Yeah, I have a group of friends, and our entire friendship seems to be based around laughter. It's always a competition to see who can be funniest. It's always a competition to see who can be the most outrageous, tell the craziest jokes, just be overall the most comedic person in
the
room.
So you're really feeling oxytocin and endorphins.
I guess
exactly.
So, yeah.
And that's the thing about love. What do you associate with love is laughing, because once your guard is down, it's easier to laugh. I make you laugh, you make me laugh. And you asked before, you know, do I really like this person, or is it just that they make me feel good? So what is
right,
that?
Right.
That's the reality, is that when they make you feel good, is what counts. Mm. But what your brain is saying is, yes, but will you be there tomorrow? This feels
right.
So good now, but that builds the expectation of more. And if you're a sort of a love 'em and leave 'em kind of person, or if you do one nice thing to me but one mean thing to me, so we've all had that life experience of ups and downs. And it's important to say that betrayal is also the end of oxytocin. So in the state of nature, if I let you close enough to touch me, you could bite me, and that could kill me in the state of nature. So touch and trust always go together. I'm not going to let you close enough unless I trust you. But what if I do trust you, and then you bite me? Then I have to say, whoa, I have to really correct my circuit.
And maybe I can't let anybody close. Maybe that's the lesson.
Well,
sadly, that's what we do, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and hopefully we don't have to do that when we understand how our circuitry works, to say, yes, I built a betrayal circuit, a non-trust circuit for that person and that person, but that doesn't mean I have to build it with everyone, and to know that we can do it in stages. I could trust you this much, and then I trust you this much. And so although we have a huge gush of great feeling, part of us says, yes, but it's not safe to trust someone all at once. And it's great to know that monkeys have the same thing going on. You know, it's not just us. So when we see monkeys grooming each other, like, I'm going to pick some fur, some bugs out of your fur, it feels good. But then you may not reciprocate and pick bugs out of my fur, which feels damn bad. But maybe if I groom you for 3 days, then you will reciprocate. So monkeys are always making those tough calls.
Trust you're in a monkey.
Yeah, you're tuned into The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. I'm your host, Ben Starr, here with Kevin O'Donohue, and our guest, Dr. Loretta Bruning. Thank you so much for joining us again today. We really do appreciate it. And we're talking about your book, about Habits of a Happy Brain. And I'm wondering, we have about, well, we have a little more time than I thought before the break. But tell us about what are some of the habits of a happy brain? What are things that happy, healthy people do to maintain a happy, healthy brain?
So I want to say this in a way that everyone can apply to themselves where they are now. I don't want us to imagine that there's some idealized healthy person that we should be like them, because some research is conducted in that way, and I don't think that's necessary. So no matter where you are right now, you can find a step to take toward meeting your own needs, and that's the job your brain evolved to do. But you have a variety of different needs. Yesterday we talked about, and I'll review, dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, endorphin. Each of them you can stimulate in different ways that works in your life. So let's start with dopamine. So dopamine, it's a step toward meeting a need. So if you think, well, my needs, in order to be happy, I need to get a huge promotion, and I'm going to take a step toward getting a huge promotion. But we've all had the frustration and disappointment of feeling that, well, I've taken a lot of steps and I haven't gotten that promotion. So that's why I explain we need to have a variety of goals, because we don't have absolute power over the world. So if you have a short-run goal, a long-run goal, and a medium-run goal, and then you can shift fluidly among them so that you could always, when one path is blocked, you can do another. So for example, a medium-run goal would be, I'm going to plan this summer's vacation. So if I have 5 minutes and I just got a disappointment in my career promotion venue, then I'm going to focus for 5 minutes on planning my summer vacation and to get my dopamine back up, for example. Now,
great idea. And then also you mentioned about breaking it down, breaking the goal down.
Yeah, breaking it down into small parts. So let's think of an example. Let's
get the resume done. Go on the first interview.
Yeah.
And then reward yourself, right?
Yeah.
We were talking about that yesterday.
Yeah. So because a lot of people are lured into this, oh, well, visualize your ideal life. And then it makes this goal, it's like such a huge mountain, and then you just end up being frustrated.
It's kind of linking, Ben, like what we were talking about. You visualize your ideal life.
Yes, I was just thinking
like what
that.
We were talking last week.
Yep.
And it just is not the way to go.
Yeah.
So pulling yourself out of this idealization habit is really a way to get a spike in your dopamine or other chemical levels.
So let's think of, for example, if you have this dream of this ideal place you're going to live, what can I do in the next 45 days to feel pleasure with where I live now? So I could say, okay, for the next 45 days, I'm going to invest a half hour a day into meeting the needs of improving my living space. And you may go through every day saying, I don't have time, but you're committing to yourself that you're going to make the time. And then by the end of those 45 days, not only is your living space going to be better, but you're going to say, wow, I have the power to change something, even though every individual step felt awful. So you may say, I need a new couch, but I can't make a decision because this couch has this problem and that couch, and why don't they make the right couch, blah, blah, blah. But if you break it down into small pieces and say, okay, today I'm going to analyze the options, tomorrow I'm going to compare the options, you know, and the next day I'm going to make a decision, and give yourself the time, you'll love the results.
And that's another way of sort of describing a concept that we've discussed often on this program, which is breaking larger, seemingly unattainable goals into smaller, more realistic, and achievable smaller steps.
I wonder if people don't like goals because it sort of takes you out of the present, and we're all about getting back into the present. When the goal is...
The goal
two
is,
hours later
it's
from
always in the
something.
Future, whether it's 2 hours, two
right.
days, 2 weeks, 2 years from now.
Right.
The goal is always in the future.
Right. I'll give you two great examples of this. So how can I, if a person has that strategy of I want it to feel good now, I know there's this like present-minded thing, but I don't know, I think that has its limits. But how can I make it feel good? So if I'm preparing for a talk and I start focusing on I want to this all these great outcomes to come out of it, I may just end up frustrated. So what I do is when I'm preparing for a talk, and I have a lot of slideshows on my website, I tell myself that I'm enjoying the act of creating that slideshow because it's like a work of art. Every slide is like a little work of art. And I'm so excited. I look at the slide and I say, oh, I did that, you know? Right. And let's say just finding love, you know, people are like, oh, it's so hard. But like I could say that I can sit down for coffee with someone, whether they're going to be the right person or not. Isn't that fascinating to have someone's undivided attention for 45 minutes? Like you're going to learn their true thought process. That's just fun. So just focus on the fun part of each step.
Yeah. Well, it's, I think it is fun, and it's tough to have someone's undivided attention in 2016. That's the trouble.
You have to go to Starbucks.
Yeah.
Starbucks. You can meet all sorts of people with their coffee just sitting.
And their mobile devices, though. Don't forget.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm wondering, how do you know when those chemicals are flowing, and how do we monitor those chemicals? I mean, no one's walking around with a monitor that gives them an idea of what their exact dopamine, serotonin, and oxytocin levels are. So how do we identify that within ourselves?
You know what? You really don't need to worry about that, because that is the part of your brain that evolved before language. So that works perfectly well, whether you attach verbal labels to it or not. So the main thing is that gets people wanting to focus on this is if you have unpleasant experiences that you don't want to have, what we've learned is that, so in the state of nature, you only feel threatened when there's an actual threat reaching your sensory receptors. But we humans are skilled at anticipating problems and solving them in the past. So we can anticipate a million problems into the infinite future, and then it's so hard to not be stressed. So we've learned that triggering your happy chemicals is a way to get you out of that abstract anticipation of problems. So that's why people say, you know, how can I feel good now to interrupt the abstract thing that I'm worried about? And we all have what I call happy habits, ways of doing that, our favorite way of interrupting the bad feeling. And any happy habit you have is subject to abuse.
What are a few examples of a happy habit?
Well, what I say in the book is you could think of 10 of them in 10 seconds, but in fact, you could do 110 seconds. You know, you could say junk food, but then even health food, like obsessing over, oh, I better not eat that. I better not eat that. I better not eat that. That's another example of like one of these focuses. So some people, you know, it could be drinking, could be gambling. It could be, excuse me, masturbation is the one that's getting
absolutely.
A lot of press today.
Absolutely. There's
pornography
addiction. Yeah, pornography addiction, that's a subject that we've touched on before.
Yeah, sure.
But let me say work is another example.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Like a workaholic?
Yeah. But relationship obsessing, you know. We have a very strong, we've talked about this, we have a strong need for social bonds. And we evolved to be group living animals. So if I'm a little baby gazelle, if I step away from the herd, I'm going to get killed instantly. So we evolved this mechanism to never want to step away from the herd. But in the modern world, we don't like to be stuck with the herd. So we're at odds with ourselves. We want to go off on our own to greener pastures, but the minute we leave it, then we feel like we need the herd.
And I definitely am going to want to hear some more about that. We're going to take a short musical break. It's just about 1:30 here in New York City. You're tuned into The Positive Mind on 99.5 FM WBAI. We'll take this short musical break, and we'll be back with more from Dr. Loretta Bruning. Thank you.
Ouvindo atentamente na vitrola, seu jeito encantado de cantar. Eu tento resistir aos seus acordes, mas só consigo me apaixonar e confessar de tudo que meu coração precisa. Fundamental é mesmo violão. um samba harmonizado por João, por João. E nesse nunca chega de saudade a sua inconfundível divisão. É toda infinita poesia que faz da melodia uma ilusão. João Gilberto, amigo, eu só queria lhe agradecer pela lição desses seus acordes dissonantes, desse seu cantar com perfeição e até o apagar. Só privilegiados têm ouvidos, mas muito pouco deles tem seu dom. Seu dom, que bom, que bom, que bom, que bom, que bom, que bom.
Rosa Passos from the Amorosa album, and the song is Essa é Projao. I wish I spoke Portuguese and I could pronounce that and do it justice. I can't, but the song is beautiful, and it's music that I was telling Dr. Bruning here is music that I was exposed to as a young child, the sort of Brazilian bossa nova jazz sound. And anytime I hear it now, it definitely affects me in a kind of this emotional way that may be related to oxytocin, we decided.
Yes, well, we all have oxytocin circuits built in youth. So whenever anything made you feel safe and protected when you were young, that turned on your oxytocin, and it connected neurons that tell you when to turn on the safe, trusting feeling in the future. Now, I was mentioning that I sort of had the opposite of experience, that when my parents fought, my father used to go and turn on music. So I have a negative association for music, unlike most people,
because
I associated it with the conflict.
Is that with all music for you?
You know, it's funny. I have a very verbal brain, so when I listen to music in a foreign language and I listen to the words, and then I love it.
So this is a great lesson, though. I mean, you must have had to learn how to enjoy something that everybody does naturally, music. And so you might have created a neural pathway to bypass your disgust or whatever, your fear reaction, and now enjoy music. You must enjoy music.
Well, you know, frankly, as I said, I love the verbal part of it, and so I learn the words of some songs,
okay.
And then I really
okay.
enjoy singing them. But for the most part, I don't get much enjoyment
really?
Out of music the way other people do. And I think everyone has their tools that they use,
mm-hmm.
and we can either learn to develop the tools we have, and I talk about grafting a new habit onto old roots, or develop other things. So, for example, for me, I like to laugh, and I like comedy, so I make time in my life for that.
Maybe stand-up comedy?
All different kinds, and so I make time for that where other people might have turned to music. But I have to say that a lot of comedy I don't like, so then I have to listen to some things that annoy me in order to get to the thing I like. So everything takes some effort to bring
well,
the positive in.
One of the lessons from your book is that the impulse to feel good and the impulse to avoid feeling bad is what allows us to survive, and what allows us to survive as individuals and as species.
Yeah,
right?
Amazing.
What's gotten us to this point, right?
the amazing thing is that in the state of nature, if it feels good, it's good for you. So Oreo cookies didn't exist in the state of nature. So,
right.
You know, sugar was rare. Colorful fruits were rare. So when you'd see them, you'd just chow down because there were so few opportunities to do that. So in the state of nature, if it felt good, it was good for you. But in the modern world, that doesn't work, which is why we have to work so hard at building neural pathways that modify and redirect our impulses to feel good so that we could have long-term survival, which is what the human brain focuses on, the long-term.
Survival of the species, for example, right?
No.
Or you mean long-term individual survival?
Animals focus on survival behaviors that feel good right now. But we humans have learned that some things that feel good right now will bite you in the face in the long run.
Like cigarettes.
Yeah.
Which we talked about yesterday.
Yeah. Or approaching attractive mating partners on the street.
Mm-hmm.
as a monkey would do, you know. So that's why we have to work so hard at building new circuits to turn on our chemicals in new ways. And you asked about what it takes to build those circuits, and it's really fascinating. So the electricity in your brain flows like water in a storm. It finds the paths of least resistance. So your electricity is going to flow down the pathways that you have unless you build new pathways. But it's hard to do that because electricity has a hard time flowing down a new pathway. So once you try to do something,
especially when it's gotten used to the same pathways that are convenient and known.
Yeah, so the old pathways, your electricity flows so easy that it's effortless, and we take that for feeling like that's true and that's right. Because the way that old pathway got to be there is it was real and true when you were young. So when you were young, anything that felt good connected a neuron, and if that experience was repeated, that neural pathway got paved. So there's a substance that paves your neural pathways called myelin, and it coats them with fat, and that turns a neural pathway into a superhighway. And then the electricity flows so easy that it's just effortless and natural. And I use the example of watching a three-year-old child skiing, or, you know, some child who learned to speak a language when they were young that you struggle with. So our brain is full of myelin when we're under age 8 and during puberty. And that's the times of our peak neuroplasticity. So for the rest of your life, you want to use those pathways because electricity flows. And anytime you deviate from them, your brain says, whoa, this is not good for your survival. This is not good for your survival. Partly because you're leaving the survival path, and partly because it takes so much energy to do something different.
And it's a new trick, and now you're an old dog, right?
It's the first step to recognize which pathways were not good for survival. Like, I mean, Oreo cookies and candy. Kids who get fed candy as a way to discipline them, or, you know, keep them in order. You know, it wasn't their fault that they developed that association and rely on that electricity. It's the first thing as an adult, for an adult, to say, this really isn't going to help my survival and my long-term health or whatever you want to use. But basically getting back to survival, Oreo cookies are not going to help my survival.
Yeah, but the problem is there's no perfect pathway because our brain habituates to good things. So, for example, people who are very concerned with having a healthy diet and let's say, oh, I discover kale. It's fabulous. I eat kale every day for 6 months. After a while, kale is not going to thrill you.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're constantly obsessing over what you're afraid to eat, then you lose that joy of nourishing your body, and then you're making it into a problem, which is why we need to have a few different avenues to feel good rather than just worry.
Multiplicity, finding multiplicity, you know, doing many, many different things, trying many, many different foods, many, many different. That's what I loved about Armand. You know, he would find, even at 75, he was finding, discovering new music. He was always challenging himself to find another pleasure, even, you know, using the senses that he had to find another vehicle, another way.
So it
prevents you from getting stuck. Sorry.
Oh, excuse me. Relationships getting stale, you know, is another common example of this.
Yeah.
And you can start finding fault in the person because they're not stimulating your happy chemicals the way they used to. Whereas once you lose that person, then you're like, yikes, wow, I had something good.
Well, I've heard women often say men get bored of women, right? I've heard many women say that in terms of how, you know, their experience in the dating world. Is there a way that we can forge new neural pathways with our partners?
Well, we know this idea of the excitement of new romance. What I talk about in my book, Love is a Cocktail of Neurochemicals, it triggers all of them. So dopamine triggers the chase aspect of love. And then once you got that, then you don't get much more of it. So that's why if you want to have an enduring relationship, it's not realistic to expect that you're going to have that first date feeling or first kiss feeling or first commitment feeling the rest of your life. I don't think it's a reasonable burden to put on yourself.
So what is the strategy to stick the oxytocin route and keep the oxytocin steady?
So the oxytocin aspect of a relationship is to think how nice it is that you can trust this person. The serotonin aspect of it, no one likes to admit this, but there's a certain status, and it's so easy to see in others, even though you don't like to admit it yourself, that the relationship that gives you a certain amount of status. And then the endorphin aspect is actually laughing with the person. But I'm just going to use a funny oxytocin example because everyone has this sort of warm-hearted, you know, holding hands and things. But if you hold hands with the same person every day, even that, you know, because your brain habituates to good things. So I'll just tell you a funny story. I went on a, I don't know if this is
should you hold
story.
Their elbow or, you know,
or the neck?
You know, next week I'll hold your shoulder. No, I'm kidding.
No, I went on a trip with my husband and I got, let's say, a traveler's illness. And I, excuse me for saying, made a big mess. And my husband cleaned up after me. And
wow.
I thought, wow.
Sexy
I thought,
stuff.
I thought, that is like, the,
that's
you talk
love.
About,
that's
really,
real
I
love.
Thought a person that would do that for me, like every time I'm frustrated with him, I say, what a good person he is that I can count on him. And physiologically, I feel safe because I know that I can count on a person. Now, can I count on him to do something and not other? Yeah, you can't, like if I wanted to talk to him about a certain thing that he doesn't understand, then it's not realistic, and then I'm going to get disappointed. So we have to focus on what's realistic.
Appreciating a man doing chores is like a big thing.
Right. We talked about that yesterday.
Right. So, you know, his handsome looks and his bank account, you know, after you've been familiar with him for a long time, those things don't do it anymore. Actually doing the dishes really is a turn on.
It
can be.
Yeah, it depends on the individual, whatever is. But then what, if the guy already does the dishes, then it doesn't turn you on after
a
while.
Change the cat litter or something.
Well, then that's...
So you constantly have to find things to keep your mate pleased and vice versa, I guess.
Or if you want, you could constantly remind yourself, like, even though he does this for me and I'm not getting excited about it anymore, to appreciate it. That's why we have to understand our brain to appreciate what we have.
What about, I'm sorry to change the subject, but this is just something that's been on my mind in regards to your work and this book. What about thrill seekers? People who do extreme things like bungee jumping off of canyons, who have tattooed, you know, 98% of their bodies.
Yes, great question.
You know what I mean.
Like, yeah,
this is,
and
we all know
yes.
someone like
yes.
this.
So first I'm going to use one word that captures a lot of this is distraction. Okay? So as we said, an animal is only worrying about threats that are there. But we humans can worry about all kinds of threats. So being separated from the herd is a big threat. Now, in the animal world, you stick with that herd and you never leave them. But in the human world, you're expected to go off and make your own way. And then sometime they leave without you. So we have this fear of like being without the herd. And we try to distract ourselves from that fear. And if you distract yourself with a certain thing, then after a while your brain habituates and you got to do more and you got to do more. So that's what explains a lot of that. But the other thing I want to, and then you mentioned bungee jumping, adrenaline. So we didn't talk about adrenaline yet. So I think about it as if your brain has like a brake and a gas pedal. Adrenaline is like the gas pedal that says, this is really important.
Go,
this
go,
is really
go, go,
important.
Go.
Yeah, but it doesn't tell you if this is good for you or bad for you. It just amps it up. So some people like that feeling. Now, that you mentioned the tattoo. So pain, we talked about pain triggers endorphin. And so that's it. But whatever you do, then you got to do more of it. So more pain, that's not a good strategy.
Certainly not for survival out in the wild.
Exactly.
Right. You don't want to be oblivious to pain out there.
Or definitely for long-run happiness.
Yeah, right.
If your long-run happiness strategy depends on pain, yikes, that's a dead end.
Yeah, yeah.
Adrenaline is the gas pedal and cortisol is the brake. So cortisol says, stop, yikes, okay, this is no good for me. So cortisol is go back. Happy chemicals are go forward. And adrenaline is do more of whichever one that is.
Right. And hopefully in the middle is something called reason.
Restraint.
Which is another call, which isn't a chemical, but
you're tuned into The Positive Mind here on 99.5 FM WBAI. I'm Ben Starr in the studio with Kevin O'Donohue and Dr. Loretta Bruning, who has written the book Habits of a Happy Brain, How to Retrain Your Brain to Boost Your Serotonin, Dopamine, Oxytocin, and Endorphin Levels. And that's available on Amazon.com and wherever books are sold. I want to thank you again, Dr. Bruning, for taking the time to be with us here. It really does mean a lot to us and our listeners that you'll teach us a little bit about brain chemistry and what it relates to and where it comes from.
Kevin just mentioned reason. So let's talk about what that is, because it's really fascinating. So if you look at how the mammal brain evolved, each species has the same core operating system, the limbic system, like the little bits and parts of the amygdala and hypothalamus that control the brain chemicals. And then we have extra neurons that are sort of like a storage system for extra new update information. And so for humans, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So we could store lots of information, but heck, what good is that? It's just like a computer. But then we have this prefrontal cortex, which is often regarded as restraint or self-restraint. So what I think of it as is like we have the plan A, which is your electricity flowing down the effortless pathways. And all that reason is a way to break your plan A to give your brain time to generate an alternative. Mm-hmm. So an ape, for example, they've noticed that apes can do some breaking and alternative generation, but only if the alternative is immediately available, whereas a human can construct a faraway alternative that's not right there. But then if you think, oh, that's pie in the sky, that's not going to work. So then I can use my big cortex to say, okay, let me come up with a plan C. But then once I come upon a plan that I think works, then I'm back to my mammal brain and my happy chemicals to act on it. So our brains are always working together. It's not like we should think that the animal brain is the bad part.
Right. And you do say, when you have this feeling of a threat to your survival, to do nothing, to just stop. And I love that because it was so connected to what we did during the fun drive with the Layman series, and Armin was talking about therapy. You know, if you go into therapy, you don't want to start judging yourself. You want to let yourself have all the thoughts you have and just don't do anything. Just watch yourself, give yourself time to see how you've been operating. So I really like that piece.
I might mention on that, this might be helpful to people. Most of my relatives are deceased, so I'm in the free position of being able to say things. So I was beaten when I was a kid. And when the first time I spoke about that to a therapist, I was literally shaking. And I didn't even know why, you know, but I think this is sort of like, you shouldn't talk about it. And when you're shaking, many people may feel that they're worse off. Like, oh my God, I let the lid off.
No.
But then since then, like, oh, it doesn't bother me at all. So it's really good to give yourself time and, you know, however many days it takes to say, I'm building a new pathway in my brain that says, I can feel good in the life I have now, regardless of whatever other wacky circuits I built in the past, which everybody built wacky circuits.
And that's, that's so important. And just because of what you said, that everybody has some circuits that don't necessarily serve them, right, in their current existence, whether that circuit is being ashamed of something that happened when they were younger or some destructive habits that they've picked up along the way that were reinforced through these neural pathways that you describe, everyone in one way or another can relate to that statement.
And you're not consciously choosing to activate that pathway, but because it's so big, the electricity flows there effortlessly. And that's why when you mentioned doing nothing, so doing nothing is to break that impulse to let electricity flow effortlessly. And when you do nothing, you give yourself time to generate a plan B, and that is the crux of free will. And this is very important because in academia, they are denying the existence of free will. And I think that's a bad call.
Wow. Is that true? Really? Yeah. What are they saying instead of free will? Is that's just everything is nature versus nurture? Or
yeah, they're saying, you know, just like me, that those neural pathways got constructed. But the point is that you have that moment where you can redirect your electricity and say, instead of just flowing with, you know, the whole person that says, oh, I thought I was going to eat one cookie and then I ate the whole box and I felt like I had no power over it, to say, oh, I do have power over it. I just lost where the switch was.
Not sure. At MSU, you do have free will. Let's make stuff up, university.
Yeah.
So there's free will for some of us. But, you know, when you were talking about, do nothing, you know, I had the image of an alcoholic who's at a party, you know, who's giving up alcohol, somebody who's trying to get over their addiction, who's at a party and everybody's drinking, and they feel this threat to their survival, this threat to their sobriety. And just there, I picture them stopping and giving themselves an alternative, like, what do I do to adjust to this situation? Actually, exposure to the situation gives them a chance to see what might be an alternative.
Yeah, it's great. And what is the alternative? So it's good to think about at the deepest core level. I think for a lot of people, to deny yourself a drink triggers a bad feeling, like, whoa, it's not fair. Everybody gets to go out and play, and I don't.
Yeah.
So is to understand that you're having that thought, and then to say, I'm not denying myself
I'm
a drink.
Choosing
I'm
sobriety.
Giving myself the opportunity to feel good in a new way.
Yeah, right.
That's a very important point. And you know what? I'm a big advocate of free will. I'm never quite comfortable with any school of thought that denies people agency or free will. I think it's important for us to be able to make our own choices. And that's just my personal opinion, man. Just about it for it today. We are.
I did want to
running,
close with the quote from the book. You know, just the last two sentences.
I love that.
Yeah, because you know this is not easy. What we were talking about yesterday and today is not easy. It's not easy to take control of your brain chemistry, your emotions, your heart, your thinking. It's not easy, and especially with what Dr. Brenning was saying with the myelination. Is that the word that we've developed? You know, since adolescence. So. How do you undo this? Well, she ends by saying it's not easy to manage this brain that we've inherited from our ancestors. It's the challenge that comes with the gift of life. You know, the other animals don't have to worry about this. But being human is a gift, you know, and we get to choose. And thank you, Dr. Brenning, for bringing us these multitude of gifts these last 2 days.
Absolutely.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's been a great pleasure. Again, Dr. Loretta Brenning, author of Habits of a Happy Brain, find it on Amazon or wherever books are sold. And you can find us online on the iTunes store. It's absolutely free. Just search Positive Mind, and you can subscribe to our podcast. Get all your new episodes automatically downloaded to your computer. And, of course, here on WBAI every Tuesday and Wednesday at 1 p.m. And send us an email. You can always reach us at positivemind@wbai.org. We love hearing from you. We'll always try to respond to all inquiries, questions, comments, love letters, hate mail, whatever it might be. Send us a line, positivemind@wbai.org.
And also we want to say that we're looking for authors to come on.
Absolutely.
You know, this was a great experience for us. We haven't had a guest like this in a while. It was a great book to read. And we do read the book. So if you are a psychologist, a therapist, somebody who's interested in healing, send us a book and come on over.
Yeah, the address here is 119 West 57th Street, Suite 1100, New York, New York. And that's where you can send us a book if you have an interesting book to talk about.
Or call 212-757-4488.
That's right. Thanks again, and we'll be back on Tuesday at 1 p.m.
Thank you.